From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
We're asking for accountability, accountability for these offenses that goes beyond just low-level troops, but all the way up the chain of command to the office of the Secretary of Defense.
More evidence emerges that U.S. troops carried out extensive torture on detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll speak with the ACLU and Human Rights Watch. We take a look at the groundbreaking story of UNICAL in Burma. 15 Burmese villagers have brought suit and won in a landmark human rights case against the U.S. multinational corporation UNICAL. Then the Justice Department may be investigating who leaked news of a top-secret spy satellite program under debate in Congress. And an undercover intelligence officer is suing the CIA. He says his managers asked him to falsify his reporting on weapons of mass destruction and retaliated against him when he refused. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A high-ranking Air Force lieutenant general has admitted the Iraqi resistance is, quote, becoming more effective in its attacks on U.S. forces and Iraqi troops backed by the interim government. Air Force Lieutenant General Lance Smith's comments came on the same night that a major bomb killed up to 10 people in the holy Shiite city of Karbala. The blast occurred at the gate to a major Shiite shrine, the Imam Hussein Mausoleum. An aide to the Shiite leader, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, was among the wounded. The bombing marks the first serious attack in Karbala in several months. It came on the first day of campaigning for the January 30th election to pick a 270-member National Assembly. In Washington, President Bush warned Iran and Syria not to interfere in the Iraqi elections. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Iraqi fighters killed 5 people today, including the deputy head of the communications ministry. The official, Qasim Mahawi, was assassinated on his way to work. The Associated Press reports 8 of his bodyguards were hospitalized from injuries in the attack. The latest test of the national defense system has failed, raising new questions about the feasibility of the program that's already cost some $130 billion. The Bush administration has claimed the so-called Star Wars system is needed to protect the nation from a missile attack. Originally, Bush had called for a limited system to be in place by the end of this year. CNN's reporting the State Department is planning to take the unusual step of designating a television station a terrorist organization. The station, Al-Manar, is run by the Lebanese group Hezbollah. The station is currently available in this country on satellite television. Once the State Department declares the station is a terrorist organization, it'll be knocked off the air. Earlier this week, the French government also banned the station. A new audio tape reportedly recorded by Osama bin Laden has appeared on the internet. On the tape, the man identified as bin Laden praises last month's attack on the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia and criticized the Saudi regime as being controlled by the United States. Britain's highest court has ruled that the government cannot indefinitely jail terrorism suspects without giving them a trial. The court described the government's detention policies as draconian and in violation of international human rights law. Meanwhile, more questions are being raised about a U.S. practice of secretly detaining wanted men around the world than flying them to other countries to be interrogated and jailed. Just weeks after the press revealed that the U.S. government was secretly leasing a Gulfstream jet from a little-known Massachusetts company for such a purpose, the company has sold the plane. The Boston Globe reports Premier Executive Transport Services sold the jet to an Oregon company called Bayard Foreign Marketing 2 days after an article about the jet appeared in the Sunday Times of London. Almost nothing is known about either company. The Sunday Times reported the CIA and other government agencies leased the plane and used it over 300 times to pick up detainees around the world, then secretly deliver them to countries, including Egypt, Syria, and Uzbekistan, that have poor human rights records records and practice torture in their jails. The plane first gained attention in Sweden. In December 2001, the U.S. government requested Swedish officials detain two Egyptian-born men. After the men were detained, the men were secretly flown aboard the Gulfstream to Egypt, where they claimed they were drugged by U.S. agents and tortured with electric shocks. There has been speculation that the plane was sold from one government front company to another. The CIA has a long history of secretly owning airlines. Starting in the 1950s, the agency began building up a large network of airlines that eventually included about 200 planes and nearly 20,000 employees, making the agency one of the world's largest airline operators at the time. Among the CIA-operated airlines was Air America, also Air Asia, and Intermountain Aviation. In news from Ukraine, new blood tests show that opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko has the second worst case of dioxin poisoning ever recorded. His blood contains 6,000 times the normal level of dioxin. He's believed to have been poisoned in early September. In news from Sudan, a top United Nations official has warned that hundreds of thousands of people could die in the western Darfur region if aid workers are forced to leave because of violence. The Guardian of London's reporting that the Alabama politician who's proposed banning books containing gay characters from public libraries has been a frequent guest of the Bush White House. Earlier this week, state legislator Gerald Allen was scheduled to visit the White House for the fifth time. Last month, Allen put forward a state bill that would force all public libraries and schools in Alabama to throw out any book with a gay character or any book that simply recognizes homosexuality. The country's main pharmaceutical lobbying group has hired departing Republican Congressmember Billy Towson as its new chief with an annual salary of around $2 million. Up until February, the Louisiana politician served as chair of the House Committee with jurisdiction over drug industry issues. He was the principal author of the new Medicare drug law, which was strongly backed by the pharmaceutical industry. In other lobbying news, former Republican Congressmember James Greenwood of Pennsylvania is soon to become the head of the Biotechnology Industry Organization. Greenwood is the former head of the Energy and Commerce Investigative Subcommittee. The Geneva-based World Meteorological Association has announced that 2004 is on track to being the fourth hottest year since record-keeping began in 1861. And in news from Virginia, the Washington Post reports two police officers recently visited the home of an 11-year-old and questioned his parents for 3 hours about anti-American comments their son made in school. The student had refused to participate in a Veterans Day exercise and criticized the Marines. The school claimed he'd said, quote, "I wish all Americans were dead and that American soldiers should die." The police questioned his parents about their views on September 11th, the military, and if they knew any foreigners who criticized U.S. policy. They also inquired whether the parents might be teaching anti-American values at home. The mother, Pamela Albaugh, told the Washington Post, quote, "It was intimidating. I told them it's like a George Orwell novel, that it felt like they were the thought police." She went on to say, quote, "If someone would have asked me 5 years ago if this was something my government would do, I would have said never." Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More evidence has emerged that U.S. troops in Iraq carried out extensive torture inside Iraqi jails. Newly released military documents show Marines carried out mock executions, used electric shocks, and burned prisoners. The documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act have revealed that at least 13 Marines were court-martialed for taking part in the abuse. Some were jailed. The names of the Marines were blacked out of the documents. None of their cases have been previously reported. In one case, three Marines were convicted after they, quote, ordered four juvenile Iraqi looters to kneel beside two shallow fighting holes, and a pistol was discharged to conduct a mock execution. The documents were obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has admitted that at least eight detainees have died in U.S. custody in Afghanistan. The omission came following a critical report by Human Rights Watch that assailed the military's culture of impunity on prisoner abuse. We're joined in our studio by John Sifton, Human Rights Watch researcher on Afghanistan. And on the telephone, we're joined by Amrit Singh, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. John Sifton, let's begin with you. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the documents that you have obtained? You tried for a while to get documents on what happened in Afghanistan.
Well, we asked for access to the prisons themselves and then also for documents, but we were unable to obtain them. The ACLU, which is a little bit better at this sort of thing than we are, was able to get a large, large number of documents released to them from the Pentagon.
And what exactly have you learned?
Well, we're still going through the documents. The ACLU is going through the documents. Journalists all over the world are going through these documents. They haven't been gone over with a fine-tooth comb. But what we're worried about is that early on, in 2002, before the Iraq War, there were instances of prison abuse and death in Afghanistan, which were never adequately prosecuted or even investigated. And we believe that that failure in Afghanistan sort of set the tone, if you will, for Iraq about whether you could get away with abusing detainees. The answer was yes.
And what have you learned about these eight detainees who were killed? Where were they held? What happened to them?
Well, it's all across the board different. Some of them were killed in 2002, some were 2003, some as recently as September 2004. It's a variety of locations, some at Bagram Air Base, the central location, and some at forward operating bases, small military bases on the Pakistani border. We believe now that the Bagram Air Base is not a place where abuse takes place regularly. They've standardized their procedures there, and detainees who are released from that facility no longer are complaining about mistreatment. It's the forward operating bases, the ones along the Pakistani border where special forces operate, that we have the most concern about now. And that's where the most recent deaths have taken place.
And what did you learn about the eight detainees who were killed? How were they killed?
Well, you can never really know. Unfortunately, the bodies were mostly put in the ground, but two of them were subjected to an autopsy after their deaths at Bagram Air Base in December 2002. The military pathologists in those cases found that they had been killed, that they had suffered, you know, a homicide as opposed to a natural death. We also know that the Army Criminal Investigative Command considered an earlier death a, quote, murder. That's what the documents showed that were released to the ACLU. But there's very little is known other than what families say about the bodies when they're returned. You know, are there bruises on it, things like that.
December 2002, Mozambique, one of the hundreds of men who continues to be held at Guantanamo much of the time in solitary, says he believes that the reason he's being held is because he partially witnessed two murders of detainees at the Bagram Air Base. Could these be them?
It's possible that those two are the same, but there's really no way to prove it at this point. One of the reasons we're asking for accountability is not just for the sake of accountability, but also because trials, if they go forward, court-martials, will reveal a lot. The documents and the information that come out during trials point to other information, and then, you know, it's like a snowball. And that's why we're calling for accountability. It's not just about going after these troops on the ground, either. It's about finding out what were the systematic failures in the Department of Defense that allowed the abuse to happen.
Has anyone been charged?
Well, there have been scores and scores of abuse allegations, these eight deaths in Afghanistan. Only one person has been charged in the military for dereliction of duty in connection with those December deaths. And then a CIA contractor was indicted in North Carolina court in May of this year. That man, we don't know exactly why it was only him and why the military wasn't brought in any way. So it's not an adequate response. The bottom line is not enough people have been prosecuted, given the fact that literally scores of allegations have been made.
Moving from Afghanistan to Iraq, Amrit Singh, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Amrit Singh, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, you have also learned, obtaining documents under the Freedom of Information Act, that in Iraq, a number of U.S. soldiers, 13 Marines, have been court-martialed for taking part in abuse of detainees. What exactly do you know at this point?
Well, what we received was a summary chart relating to allegations that were quote-unquote substantiated. It's hard to tell exactly what happened in each case in great detail, but we know that dating back to April of 2003, there were specific documented incidents of torture and abuse by United States Marines, and the incidents including the ordering of four Iraqi juveniles to kneel while a pistol was discharged in a mock execution, the burning of a detainee's hands by covering them in alcohol and igniting them, and the shocking of a detainee with an electric transformer causing the detainee to, quote, dance as he was shocked. And all of these incidents happened at varying times in Iraq at places other than Abu Ghraib, dating back to April of 2003, before the alleged incidents at Abu Ghraib took place. There are also incidents, we also know of incidents that happened in Iraq after the Abu Ghraib incidents took place, from documents turned over by the Defense Intelligence Agency.
I'm just looking at an Associated Press piece that has come in out of San Diego, and it says a total of 130 American troops have been punished or charged in cases involving abuse of prisoners in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay. This, according to the Pentagon, more than 100 of the cases involve the Army, which has deployed the bulk of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and provides most of the guards at sites holding detainees. The others are Marines and Navy SEALs. Is this consistent with what you're learning, Amrit Singh?
Well, I cannot speculate as to the total number of allegations or the total number of prosecutions. So far, we have received only a fraction of the documents relating to detainee abuse from the government, but 130 does seem to be on the small. It seems to be a small number given the sense we have of widespread abuse.
John Sifton, what is the punishment that soldiers receive?
Well, that's exactly the issue here. We've seen again and again that investigations have proceeded and people have been, quote unquote, punished. But it's not a prosecution. It's not the same thing. You can have an administrative punishment, as little as an admonishment or a reprimand. You know, you can have your pay cut. You can have your rank reduced. Those aren't court martials. Those are merely administrative disciplinary proceedings.
And one of the things you just pointed out, saying that these go back certainly before we saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib and after the killings in Afghanistan move forward after all of this came out.
Yes, and I think it's the early cases which in many ways are the most important, because if you look at, for instance, one of the cases the ACLU uncovered of a murder that took place, the earliest known death of a detainee in U.S. custody, it took place, four people, a captain and three sergeants were implicated in a murder. According to the Post, which talked to internal Pentagon people 2 days ago, Washington Post, nothing happened in that case. Only one person received a disciplinary punishment.
This Afghanistan or Iraq?
This is Afghanistan. This is before the Iraq War. Now, that's, if you send that message to interrogators, well, you killed a guy, but, you know, it's okay. Go on to Iraq where you're going to, you know, do interrogations at Abu Ghraib. Then they're going to commit more abuse. But it's important to realize we can't just pin this all on the interrogators. You have to look at the Secretary of Defense's office and all the way down to the White House, the legal counsel, and ask, what did they do that allowed all of this to keep on happening?
In Iraq, Amrit Singh, the 13 Marines court-martialed, what do you know about specifically what they did in those cases?
As I mentioned to you,
in addition to that one,
we know only of sort of very broad summary descriptions of what the allegations against these individuals were, and they include the mock executions, burning of a detainee's hands, shocking a detainee with an electric transformer, holding a pistol to the back of a detainee's head while another Marine took a picture. These are some of the more egregious examples of the kind of treatment that U.S. Marines subjected detainees to.
Are you satisfied, and let me put this question to both of you, starting with John Sifton, are you satisfied with the response, with the media coverage in this country, and with the political leaders responding, both those in power and the Democrats who are not in power?
Well, there's media response, and then there's media response. A lot of these deaths actually were reported. Carlotta Gall, the New York Times, reported the two deaths well over a year ago. Just nothing really happened. We reported on abuse in Afghanistan, but we didn't have pictures, so it didn't have the Abu Ghraib effect. So certainly there's been media coverage. It just hasn't garnered much action. The issue now is whether all of these continuing allegations are going to lead anywhere, and whether the Senate will resume hearings like they said they would. And the question now is, will the Senate Armed Forces Committee resume hearings into this or not?
What are Democrats doing about this? John Kerry did not make an issue of this in the campaign at all that I can remember.
Well, the Democrats, as everybody knows, are not in charge, but they can push. At the end of the day, though, I think John McCain and Senator Warner, they can push this issue forward if they wish to. They were interested in pushing it forward this summer, so there's no reason why they can't push it forward again.
You've written a letter to Donald Rumsfeld?
We've written a letter to Donald Rumsfeld, but the issue now is whether the Senate will actually sort of force the Office of the Secretary of Defense to respond to these allegations. The CIA is also implicated, and there are questions to be asked there.
There are isolated attempts by senators to ask questions of the government. Senator Leahy wrote in response to some of the documents we received relating to abuse observed by the FBI. Senator Leahy wrote a letter to Robert Mueller asking for clarification as to those incidents of abuse. Senator Bingaman has also written a letter to Donald Rumsfeld asking for clarification related to some of the abuse. The question, as John puts it, is whether there will be a coordinated attempt to really find out who was ultimately responsible for the abuse.
Finally, Neil Lewis in today's New York Times writes that several former high-ranking military lawyers say they're discussing ways to oppose President Bush's nomination of Alberto Gonzalez to be attorney general, asserting that Gonzalez's supervision of legal memorandums that appeared to sanction harsh treatment of detainees, even torture, showed unsound legal judgment. Hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination are expected to begin next month. While Gonzalez is expected to be confirmed, objections from former generals and admirals would be a setback and an embarrassment for him and the White House. John Sifton on Alberto Gonzalez.
Well, the Gonzalez hearings will be an excellent opportunity to raise what involvement the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the White House had in approving techniques, which then sort of spilled over into more abusive techniques. Because it's going to be very difficult, I think, for Gonzalez to explain how he approved certain techniques and then sort of said, well, I didn't know that that would spill over into other techniques. You can't approve really harsh techniques and then assume the troops are just going to draw the line arbitrarily and not go and commit more egregious abuses. It was obvious that that was going to happen. And in a way, I think what needs to be asked is whether the White House pushed for that indeed to happen in some kind of subtle way by encouraging people to use harsh techniques.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. If people want to see these documents online, where can they go?
They go to www.aclu.org/torturefoia. That's torture FOIA.
Thank you. Amrit Singh of the American Civil Liberties Union and John Sifton of Human Rights Watch. And you can go to our website at democracynow.org, and we will link to all the relevant links. Thanks very much, both, for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll talk about a groundbreaking lawsuit against Unocal and the settlement that's just been reported. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV stations, on PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Networks Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And on all our television broadcasts, we do closed captioning to give access to the hard of hearing and the deaf in this country. A groundbreaking settlement has been reached in the long-running human rights case brought by Burmese villagers against the energy giant Unocal. A dozen Burmese villagers sued Unocal in the California courts, claiming the company was aware of and supported slave labor, murder, rape, and forced relocation of villagers by the Burmese military during the reconstruction of an oil pipeline from Burmese oil fields to Thailand. Human rights activists have hailed the settlement as a landmark test in holding multinational corporations responsible in the United States for atrocities committed abroad. We're joined by Sandra Colliver, Executive Director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, which is based in San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sandra.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Can you talk about the significance of this case? Who brought the lawsuit? We're just hearing drips and drabs. It hasn't been discussed in full what this settlement is.
That's right. The actual settlement has not been confirmed, but the case has been brought on behalf of the villagers in Burma that have been living along a gas pipeline built by Unocal and its partners. The organizations involved are the Center for Constitutional Rights, Earth Rights International, and the International Labor Rights Fund.
And can you talk about the people that they brought the lawsuit on behalf of, these 15 Burmese villagers?
The suit is brought by these villagers who were among those who were enslaved by the Burmese military as the Unocal and its partners were building this pipeline. In addition to being enslaved and conscripted into clearing the dense forest around which the pipeline had to be built, the Burmese military also terrorized the villages if the young men refused to work for free under very harsh circumstances. The terror included raping the women, killing people, and ensuring that the men could not run away from this enforced labor. Now, none of this is directly attributed to Unocal employees. Rather, what the district court found is that there was substantial evidence that Unocal knowingly assisted the perpetration of these crimes. And that was the key issue. Was Unocal as a corporation aiding and abetting the commission of human rights violations?
Now, when exactly was this lawsuit brought?
It was filed in 1996. The pipeline was finally completed in 1998. And UNICAL has been sort of trying to remedy what it realizes was a bad deal from the start. They have been saying, well, that by being in Burma, they've improved the economy around the gas pipeline. But indeed, with this settlement, they have undertaken to provide education and assistance for the community and reparations for those who were most hideously injured.
So it's been about 8 years. What do you think made UNICAL decide right now to settle?
There was scheduled to be a hearing at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals this last Monday, and that would be a hearing on the theory of aiding and abetting. The U.S. government had filed a brief in this case arguing that corporations should not be held liable pursuant to a theory of aiding and abetting because this theory would discourage foreign investment. If corporations could be held responsible for aiding and abetting human rights violations, they would be less inclined to invest overseas, and that would interfere with the discretion of the U.S. government to promote its foreign policy objectives by encouraging robust investment. So what the U.S. government was saying is that they needed to have the flexibility to tolerate the commission of human rights abuses by corporations in order to promote their foreign policy. Well, that's a bankrupt argument at best. It's frightening to think that the government would argue that they need the flexibility to authorize human rights violations in order to conduct their foreign policy. It's very clear that the government has a wide range of methods available to it to conduct foreign policy, but it's also very clear that certain activities are simply beyond the pale. One of those that the courts have clearly established is that U.S. corporations cannot engage in corruption when in this country or overseas. The U.S. government has made very clear that companies and U.S. actors cannot engage in terrorism. Why should human rights violations be different? This was the argument that was going to be advanced on Monday, and my interpretation is that UNICAL realized that was a bankrupt argument.
Finally, can you talk about the Alien Tort Claims Act, what this act is and the significance of its use in this case?
The basis of this lawsuit is the Alien Tort Claims Act, which was adopted in 1789. The law provides that non-U.S. citizens are entitled to sue in U.S. federal courts for violations of the law of nations. That law was little used until 1980, when the Center for Constitutional Rights used it in a lawsuit brought by the family of a Paraguayan man who was tortured to death by a Paraguayan official who was found in the United States. The courts condoned that use of the law, and just this year in June, the Supreme Court further emphasize that that law can be applied for modern-day human rights violations. What the court said is that originally it was anticipated that the law would be used against piracy and attacks on ambassadors and slave trading, and that in the modern day, the same law could be used for torts in violation of the law of nations that had received the same degree of consensus and definition as had those three torts in 1789. So as long as there is a tort that has the same degree of consensus as the tort of piracy and the same degree of definition, that tort can be the basis of a civil lawsuit. I want to make clear that since UNICAL was the first lawsuit filed against a corporation under this theory, and since 1996, about 40 cases have been filed. Now, the corporations have argued that this law opens up a floodgate. And I want to make clear that the courts have been very responsible in kicking out these lawsuits if they don't meet a very high standard of legal and factual proof. So the courts have kicked these cases out for forum nonconvenience, meaning inconvenient forum, that the lawsuit should be filed in the country where the violations occurred, in Burma or Nigeria. But there has to be an effective legal system in order to dismiss on that basis. The courts have kicked out cases for statute of limitations, for political question, for act of state, meaning that the lawsuit would interfere with U.S. foreign policy interests, but in a narrow way. And they've kicked out these cases just saying that the allegations are not sustained by even a sufficient degree of proof for them to go forward to a jury. So out of the 40 cases that have been filed, Unical was the first one to get this far along, and there are only six others that have so far survived an initial motion to dismiss. That's a very small percentage of cases against corporations for their activities in foreign countries.
And isn't it true that one of those cases that's still going forward is the case against Chevron for involvement in the killing of villagers in the Niger Delta?
That's right.
Finally, Sandra Colliver, in this groundbreaking case and this settlement that we're just hearing about right now, how much are the victims going to get, the plaintiffs going to get?
The terms of the settlement are confidential and are still being worked out through next February. We're assuming it's in the millions, and that millions will go far. It could be tens of millions. I really don't have any information.
The Guardian of London is reporting that the Unical's legal costs alone are estimated to be at something like $25 million.
That's right.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Sandra Colliver. Again, a groundbreaking settlement has been reached in the long-running human rights case brought by Burmese villagers against the energy giant Unical, based in California. Sandra Colliver, Executive Director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, which is based in San Francisco. And now we move to another case, the Inuit, about 155,000 seal-hunting people scattered around the Arctic, plan to seek a ruling from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that the United States, by contributing substantially to global warming, is threatening their existence. The Inuit plan is a part of a broader shift in the debate over human-caused climate change, evident among participants in the 10th round of international talks taking place in Buenos Aires, aimed at averting dangerous human interference with the climate system. The commission is an investigative arm of the Organization of American States and has no enforcement powers. But a declaration that the United States has violated the Inuit's rights could create the foundation for an eventual lawsuit, either against the United States in an international court or against U.S. companies in federal court. Last month, an assessment of Arctic climate change by 300 scientists for the eight countries with Arctic territory, including the U.S., concluded that human influences are now the dominant factor. We're joined right now by Martin Wagner, who is managing attorney for the International Programs at Earth Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you explain what the Inuit are charging?
Well, as you suggested, the Inuit's entire lives and culture, their ability to continue to survive, depends upon the ice that has existed in the Arctic for thousands of years and has supported their culture and their way of life. And scientists are now in agreement that climate change, caused predominantly by human influences, is causing that ice to melt and causing other impacts to the Inuit way of life. The Inuit can no longer depend upon the ice to get to seals that they depend on for sources of food. They can no longer travel on that ice from place to place to communicate between villages. They can no longer use the ice to build igloos that they depend on when they're out hunting. Just a whole slew of impacts that have already occurred and are going to continue to get worse. And so the Inuit are recognizing these impacts and looking at them and saying these impacts violate our fundamental rights recognized in international law to maintain our culture, to health, to have a means of subsistence that we can depend on, and other rights. And they are now seeking recognition of those violations at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
And so how does this proceed forward?
Well, we are putting together a petition that will go to the Inter-American Commission. The commission will receive the petition. It will forward it to the United States, which is the respondent. The Inuit are arguing that because the United States is responsible for 25% or more of the greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to this climate change, that the United States has an international obligation to prevent these human rights violations. So the commission would forward the petition to the United States, and they would then begin a period of hearing testimony from the Inuit and from lawyers speaking on their behalf, hearing responses from the United States, and then ultimately leading to some sort of determination by the Inter-American Commission about whether this constitutes a violation of human rights. And you rightly noted that the commission then does not have the authority to order the United States to take any particular action. But a finding by this commission, which is one of the world's most authoritative bodies on the question of human rights, can have a great impact. You mentioned some of them in terms of potential support for lawsuits that would be based on international law. But further than beyond that, diplomatic efforts by governments around the world are frequently based upon concerns about human rights, so that the many governments around the world now that have already expressed frustration with the United States for failing to participate in global negotiations and taking action globally to reduce climate change.
Not signing on to Kyoto.
For example, right. Those governments will be strengthened and empowered by an authoritative conclusion about human rights implications of climate change to be able to take stronger action with respect to the United States.
Well, Martin Wagner, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Martin Wagner is Managing Attorney for International Programs at Earth Justice. And again, at democracynow.org, we will link to information about Earth Justice and the Inuit's case. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we will look at a top-secret spy satellite program in the intelligence bill that is not supposed to be talked about. And we'll speak with a lawyer for a CIA analyst who says he was threatened for not changing his information about weapons of mass destruction. Stay with us. Smoke by Cornelius here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department and the FBI are reviewing a request for a criminal investigation into recent disclosures about a highly classified satellite surveillance program. The request from the National Reconnaissance Office comes after reports in the Washington Post and other publications about a stealth satellite program in debate in Congress, which has reportedly risen in cost from $5 billion to $9.5 billion over the last 6 years, or over the last few years. The project was debated in closed hearings on Capitol Hill, but some lawmakers took the unusual step of voicing their concerns publicly while trying to abide by classification constraints. Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia said the program was, quote, totally unjustified and very, very wasteful and dangerous to the national security. Rockefeller added, quote, because of the highly classified nature of the programs contained in the national intelligence budget, I cannot talk about them on the floor. He said the Intelligence Committee had voted to terminate the program for the past 2 years, only to be overruled by the Appropriations Committee. Rockefeller and three other Senate Democrats refused to sign conference sheets related to the 2005 Intelligence Authorization Bill, reportedly to protest the program. We're joined by Jeffrey Richelson, who's a senior fellow at the National Security Archive. He has written the book, The Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you explain what we're not supposed to know?
Well, this program had its most immediate origins during the Reagan administration, when there was great concern about Soviet anti-satellite capabilities as well as Soviet denial and deception measures. In other words, the things they did to hide secret aircraft or other military activities from U.S. reconnaissance satellites as they passed overhead. And these were satellites that were certainly trackable by the Soviet Union, so they knew when they would be over a particular target. This particular system started at that period of time and was originally named MISTI. And the idea was to put it in an orbit that the Soviets would not expect it to be in, so they wouldn't necessarily be looking there, and to give it some stealth capability so that it would be much harder to detect, so that rather than if it showed up on radar appearing to be a full-size satellite, it might appear to be some sort of debris. So they would therefore not take protective measures when the satellite was in range of a particular target, say an airbase outside Moscow, where we might want to photograph something going on. And it resulted in the first launch of the satellite in 1990. Called MISTI, and then a follow-on launch in 1999. And what's under debate is whether to approve funding for a follow-on program for which the cost has grown from $5 billion, the projected cost from $5 billion to almost $10 billion.
In the New York Times today, Douglas Jill writes that an alternative to the new highly classified $9.5 billion stealth satellite program is the subject of a congressional dispute, which relies much more heavily on high-flying unmanned aircraft to take pictures of critical targets around the world. That alternative is part of a classified proposal endorsed by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has tried since September 2003 to kill the new satellite program. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, there's always trade-offs. You can collect intelligence in a lot of different ways, and aircraft versus satellites is always a trade-off that has to be considered. And with higher performance unmanned aerial vehicles like Global Hawk or follow-on systems, there's the possibility of buying a lot of those and replacing some of your satellite capability and still saving money. There are certain advantages to satellites in that they are continuously operating, and that they are not subject to air defense. So the question would then come up whether you can fly the UAVs over targets that would not be defended and therefore get your imagery. And that's something that certainly requires an analysis, and you couldn't prejudge one way or the other.
We're talking to Jeffrey Richelson, who's written the book, The Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology. I was watching when the senator of West Virginia, Jay Rockefeller, went to the floor and said he was going to do something very unusual, that everything he said had already been approved by, I don't know, intelligence, you know, even what he was going to refer to, saying that he was objecting to the satellite program, though he didn't talk. say specifically the satellite program. How significant is it that this is coming to light?
Well, there have been other cases where a senator has objected to a particular acquisition program. Senator DeConcini years ago made some objections to a satellite program without going into any details, but it's something that doesn't happen on a regular basis. And Senator Rockefeller's description was very vague in the sense of simple, of saying a major acquisition program without specifying that it was a satellite, although that was probably fairly deducible, but also not saying what particular type of satellite.
Uh-huh. And shouldn't this be a public discussion? I mean, we're talking about $9.5 billion.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the problems with the whole, with secrecy and concerning the intelligence budget, and both for the community as a whole and specific agencies, is that you can have enormous expenditures of public funds without any sort of real public oversight. And you can see in this case the difficulty even of a major oversight committee in getting a proposal killed if there are significant forces supporting it and who can do so sort of under a veil or behind a veil of secrecy.
Finally, any comment, Jeffrey Richelson, on this test that failed yesterday of the U.S. fledgling missile defense system? An interceptor rocket failed to launch on cue from the Marshall Islands.
Well, the only thing that comes to mind is that in developing a lot of new high technology systems, you do run into a whole lot of failures up front. And the question is whether the country considers a system like this is something worth persevering in developing. I certainly can't say that I know that the technology that they're working on will work, but I can also say that you've had cases in the past with satellite systems and other, you know, high technology systems where you have had a run of failures at the beginning, and ultimately you do have success if you persevere. Whether that will happen in this case or not is something, you know, I don't know, and I don't know that anybody knows.
Well, Jeffrey Richelson, I want to thank you for being with us, Senior Fellow at the National Security Archive, the Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology is his book. As we turn now to our last subject, how a senior intelligence officer was targeted by the CIA after he refused orders from his superiors to falsify his reports on weapons of mass destruction. The senior CIA operative charges in a lawsuit that was made public last week that a coworker warned him 3 years ago that, quote, CIA management planned to get him for his role in reporting intelligence contrary to official CIA dogma. Although the word Iraq does not appear in the heavily redacted version of the suit, the Washington Post reports that, quote, the remaining language and context make clear that the officer's work related to pre-war intelligence on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. Accusations of intelligence officers being pressured on their Iraq findings in the lead-up to the war has long been alleged, but no CIA official has come public before with such claims. According to the undercover agent, the CIA management retaliated against him by launching investigations of allegations that he had a sexual affair with a female asset and that he stole money meant to pay off sources. Roy Krieger is with us. He's a D.C.-based lawyer representing the undercover CIA operative who's filing the lawsuit. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you explain exactly what happened?
Well, actually, I'm very limited in what I can say because, as you can see, and you mentioned from the on the complaint that it is heavily redacted, I can only comment on the unclassified or unredacted portions of the complaint. The CIA has pulled down the veil of secrecy on this case and classified an enormous amount of information. In my experience in the past 7 years of dealing with the CIA, I've never filed a lawsuit in which they have redacted this much of the material out of it. They took out over 400 words from a 2,400-word document, and I'm quite limited in what I can say. I can't even confirm or deny that we're talking about Iraq or any other country other than to say that it involves weapons of mass destruction in the Near East during the pre-war period. And our client, as you commented, was retaliated against after he refused requests from his supervisors in the counterproliferation division on several different occasions to falsify mistake intelligence that had been collected by him.
Is he still employed by the CIA?
No, he's not. He was in September of 2003. He was placed on paid administrative leave after these two investigations of him were launched. He was kept on paid administrative leave for 1 year, and then he received a letter notifying him that his services were being terminated. One of the investigations, the Inspector General investigation, we know is still ongoing. We met with investigators from CIA's Inspector General's office just last week at my office with my client for nearly, probably about 30 to 45 minutes, and I asked him a series of questions related to the financial fraud investigation. The counterintelligence investigation that was launched of him for allegedly having a sexual affair with an asset, I think has probably been terminated simply because his employment has been terminated and we've received no information that the investigation was handed off to the FBI, which would be a normal procedure in this case. But he is no longer employed at the CIA and he is still the subject, or I should say the target, of a criminal investigation.
Why did the lawsuit go forward now? We're talking about something that took place 3 years ago.
Well, we're talking about events that occurred 3 years ago, but the harm really occurred just a few months ago, and that's in fact when he was fired from the CIA. And the lawsuit is actually we filed it fairly quickly after he had been officially notified of his termination. First, we had to submit it to the CIA so they could make all of the redactions that you see in it, and then as soon as we got it back, we filed it with the federal court here in Washington, D.C., and we had to file it along with a motion seeking permission to proceed in pseudo, that is, not in true name, because ordinarily when you file a suit in federal court, you can only sue in your true name and true address, and here his true name is classified. Ordinarily what we do in order to protect someone's true identity is we use their true first name, which is fairly ubiquitous, of course, and then either Doe for a last name or the first initial of their true last name. In this case, if you've got the complaint before you, you can see that the CIA was so sensitive about this case that they even redacted out the true first name of our client. And so he is proceeding simply as Mr. Doe. And the chief judge issued the order last week, and as soon as the order was issued, the suit became officially filed, and that's when the media got a hold of it.
Well, Roy Krieger, I want to thank you very much for being with us, representing the undercover CIA operative who's filed the lawsuit, marking the first public instance in which a CIA employee is charged directly that agency officials pressured him to produce intelligence to support the administration's pre-war position that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and suppressing information that ran counter to that view. Roy Krieger has represented scores of people in the Central Intelligence Agency, and that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. By the way, we're looking for volunteers to help us out, sending out all the holiday gifts people are ordering around the country at our website, democracynow.org. If you want to come on by, if you live in the New York area, just email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org, or give a call. We really could use the help. We also are looking for some gifts like LCD flat screens to help us build our newsroom. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.